day the mice will play.
Of course,
Maya said, glancing over at Bat, who muttered something darkly in Spanish. For hundreds of years, the Nephilim have kept their rules and made sure that we kept to them as well, Lily said. For that, they are much resented. Now they have gone to hide themselves away in Idris, and we cannot pretend that downworlders will not enjoy certain advantages while they are gone.
Being able to eat people? Bat inquired, folding a piece of pizza in half.
It is not just vampires, Lily said coldly. Fairies love to tease and torment humans. Only shadow hunters prevent them. They will begin taking human babies again. The warlocks will sell their magic to the highest bidder, like
magical prostitutes?
They all looked up in surprise. Malcolm Fade had appeared in the doorway, brushing white flakes of snow from his already white hair.
It's what you were going to say, wasn't it?
I wasn't, said Lily, clearly caught off guard.
Oh, say what you like, I don't mind, Malcolm said brightly. Nothing against prostitution, it keeps civilization running.
He shook snow off his coat. He was wearing a plain black suit and worn trench coat. There was nothing of Magnus's glittering eclecticism about him.
How do you people stand snow? He demanded.
You people?
Bat bristled.
Do you mean werewolves?
I mean East Coasters, said Malcolm.
Who would have weather if they could avoid it?
Snow, hail, rain. I'd move to Los Angeles in a jiffy.
Did you know that a jiffy is an actual measurement of time? It's a 60th of a second. You can't do anything in a jiffy, not really.
You know, Maya said, Katarina said you were pretty harmless.
Malcolm looked pleased. Katarina said I was pretty?
Can we stick to the point? Maya demanded.
Lily, if what you're worried about is that the Shadow Hunters will take it out on all downworlders if some of us go rogue while they're in Idris, well, that's why we're doing what we're doing. Assuring downworlders that the Accords hold, the Shadow Hunters are trying to get our representatives back that Sebastian is the real enemy here, will minimize the chances of chaos outside Idris affecting what happens in the case of a battle, or when all this is over.
Katarina! Malcolm announced suddenly, as if remembering something pleasant.
I nearly forgot why I stopped by here in the first place. Katarina asked me to contact you. She's in the morgue at Beth Israel Hospital, and she wants you to come as quickly as you can.
Oh, and she said to bring a cage.
One of the bricks in the wall by the window was loose. Jocelyn had been passing the time by using the metal clip of her barrette to try to pry it free. She wasn't foolish enough to think that she could create a gap she could escape through, but she was hoping that freeing a brick would give her a weapon, something she could slam into Sebastian's head. If she could make herself do it, if she wouldn't hesitate. She had hesitated when he was a baby. She had held him in her arms and known there was something wrong with him, something irreparably damaged, but hadn't been able to act on her knowledge. She had believed in some small corner of her heart that he could still be saved. The door rattled, and she turned around, sliding the barrette back into her hair. It was Clary's barrette, something she had picked off her daughter's desk when she needed to keep her hair out of the paint. She hadn't returned it because it reminded her of her daughter, but it seemed wrong to even think of Clary here, in front of her other child, though she missed her so much that it hurt. The door opened and Sebastian stepped through. He wore a white knit shirt, and she was reminded again of his father. Valentine had liked to wear white. It had made him appear paler, his hair whiter, just that little bit more inhuman, and it did the same for Sebastian. His eyes looked like black paint dripped onto a white canvas. He smiled at her. Mother, he said. She crossed her arms over her chest. What are you doing here, Jonathan? He shook his head, still with the same smile on his face, and drew a dagger from his belt. It was narrow, with a thin blade, like an awl. If you call me that again, he said, I will put your eyes out with this. She swallowed. Oh, my baby. She remembered holding him, cold and still in her arms, not like a normal child at all. He hadn't cried, not once. Is that what you came to tell me? He shrugged. I came to ask you a question. He glanced around the room, his expression bored. And to show you something. Come, walk with me. She joined him as he left the room, with a mixture of reluctance and relief. She hated her cell, and surely it would be better to see more of the place where she was being kept. The size of it. The exits. The corridor outside the room was stone, big blocks of limestone slotted together with concrete. The floor was smooth, worn down by footsteps. Yet there was a dusty feel to the place, as if no one had been in it for decades, even centuries. There were doors set into the walls at random intervals. Jocelyn felt her heart begin to pound. Luke could be behind any of those doors. She wanted to dash at them, jerk them open, but the dagger was still in Sebastian's hand, and she didn't doubt for a moment that he knew that better than she did. The corridor began to curve around, and Sebastian spoke. "What?" he said. "If I did tell you I loved you." Jocelyn clasped her hands loosely in front of her. "I suppose," she said carefully, "that I would say that you could no more love me than I could love you." They had reached a set of double doors. They paused in front of them. "Aren't you supposed to pretend, at least?" Jocelyn said, "Could you? Part of you is me, you know. The demon's blood changed you. But did you really think that everything in you otherwise comes from Valentine?" Without answering, Sebastian shouldered the doors open and stepped inside. After a moment, Jocelyn followed, and stopped in her tracks. The room was huge and semicircular. A marble floor stretched out to a platform built of stone and wood rising against the western wall. In the center of the platform sat two thrones. There was no other word for them, massive ivory chairs overlaid with gold. Each had a rounded back and six steps leading down from it. An enormous window, glass reflecting nothing but blackness, hung behind each throne. Something about the room was oddly familiar, but Jocelyn couldn't have said exactly what. Sebastian bounded up onto the platform and beckoned her to follow him. Jocelyn moved slowly up the few steps to join her son, who stood in front of the two thrones with a look of gloating triumph on his face. She had seen the same look on his father's face when he'd gazed down at the mortal cup. "He will be great," Sebastian intoned. "And he will be called the Son of the Highest, and the devil will give him the throne of his father, and he will reign over hell forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." "I don't understand," Jocelyn said, and her voice came out bleak and dead even to her own ears. "You want to rule this world, some dead world of demons and destruction. You want to give orders to corpses?" Sebastian laughed. He had Valentine's laugh, harsh and musical. "Oh no," he said. "You misunderstand me entirely." He made a quick gesture with his fingers, something she had seen Valentine do when he taught himself magic. And suddenly the two great windows behind the thrones were no longer blank. One showed a blasted landscape, withered trees and scorched earth. Vile winged creatures circling in front of a broken moon. A barren plateau of rock spread out before the windows. It was populated by dark figures, each standing a little distance from the next, and Jocelyn realized that they were the Endarkened, keeping watch. The other window showed Alicante, sleeping peacefully in the moonlight. A curve of moon, a sky full of stars, the shimmer of water in the canals. The view was one Jocelyn had seen before, and she realized with a jolt why the room she was in had seemed familiar. It was the council room in the guard, transformed from an amphitheater to a throne room, but still the same arched roof, the same size, the same view of the city of glass from what had been two great windows. Only, Now one window looked out onto the world she knew, the Idris she had come from, and the other looked out onto the world she was in. "This fortress of mine has doorways to both worlds," said Sebastian, his tone smug. "This world is drained dry, yes. A bloodless corpse of a place. Oh, but your world is ripe for ruling. I dream about it during the days as well as the nights. Do I burn the world slowly, with plague and famine, or should the slaughter be quick and painless? All that life extinguished so quickly. Imagine how it would burn." His eyes were feverish. "Imagine the heights I could rise to, borne aloft on the screams of billions of people, raised up by the smoke of millions of burning hearts." He turned to her. "Now," he said, "tell me I got that from you. Tell me any of that is from you." Jocelyn's head was ringing. "There are two thrones," she said. A small crease appeared between his brows. "What?"
"Two thrones," she said. "And I'm not a fool. I know who you intend to have sit beside you. You need her there. You want her there. Your triumph means nothing if she isn't there to watch it. And that need for someone to love you, that does come from me."
He stared at her. He was biting his lips so hard, she was sure he would draw blood.
"Weakness," he said half to himself. "It's weakness."
"It's human," she said. "But do you really think Clary could sit next to you here and be happy or willing?" For a moment she thought she saw something spark in his eyes, but a moment later they were black ice again.
"I'd rather have her happy and willing and here. But I'll take simply here," he said. "I don't care that much about willing."
Something seemed to explode inside Jocelyn's brain. She lunged forward, reaching for the dagger in his hand. He stepped back, evading her, and spun with a quick, graceful movement, knocking her legs out from under her. She hit the ground, rolled, and crouched. Before she could rise, she found a hand knotted in her jacket, yanking her to her feet.
"Stupid bitch," Sebastian snarled, inches from her face,
the fingers of his left hand digging into the skin below her clavicle.
"You think you could hurt me? My true mother's spell protects me."
Jocelyn jerked back. "Let me go." The leftmost window exploded with light. Sebastian reeled back, surprise blooming across his face as he stared. The blasted landscape of the dead world had suddenly lit up with fire, blazing golden fire, rising in a pillar toward the broken sky. The dark shadow hunters were running to and fro over the ground like ants. The stars were coruscating, reflecting the fire back, red and gold and blue and orange. It was as beautiful and terrible as an angel. Jocelyn felt the hint of a smile touch the corners of her mouth. Her heart was lifting with the first hope she had felt since she had woken up in this world.
"Heavenly fire," she whispered.
"Indeed." A smile played around Sebastian's mouth. Jocelyn looked at him in dismay. She had expected him to be horrified, but instead he looked exalted.
"As the good book says, this is the law of the burnt offering. It is the burnt offering because of the burning upon the altar all night unto the morning. And the fire of the altar shall be burning in it," he cried, and raised both arms, as if he meant to embrace the fire that burned so high and so bright beyond the window. "Waste your fire on the desert air, my brother," he cried. "Let it pour into the sands like blood or water. And may you never stop coming. Never stop coming until we are face to face."
18. By the Waters of Babylon.
Energy runes were all well and good, Clary thought exhaustedly as she reached the top of yet another rise of sand. But they didn't begin to compete with a cup of coffee. She was pretty sure she could face another day of trudging, her feet sometimes slipping ankle deep into heaps of ash, if she just had sweet caffeine pumping through her veins.
"Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" Simon said, coming up beside her. He looked drawn and tired, his thumbs hooked through the straps of his backpack. They all looked pretty drawn.
Alec and Isabel had taken watch after the incident with the heavenly fire, and had reported no demons or dark shadow hunters in the vicinity of their hideaway. Still, they were all jittery, and none of them had had more than a few hours of sleep. Jay seemed to be running on nerves and adrenaline, following the thread of the tracking spell on the bracelet around his wrist, sometimes forgetting to pause and wait for the others in his mad dash towards Sebastian, until they shouted or ran to catch up with him. Then a massive latte from the mud truck would make everything brighter just about now?
There's a vamp place not far from Union Square where they mix just the right amount of blood into the coffee, Simon said. Not too sweet, not too salty.
Clary stopped. A dead branch, curling from the earth, had tangled itself in her bootlaces.
Remember when we talked about not sharing?
Isabel listens to me talk about vampire things.
Clary drew out Tears Force. The sword with the new rune carved black into the blade seemed to shimmer in her hand. She used the tip of it to pry the tough, thorny branch free.
Isabel is your girlfriend, she said. She has to listen to you.
Is she? Simon looked startled.
Clary threw her hands up and started down the hill. The ground slanted down, pocked here and there with cracked pits, everything covered over with the endless dull sheen of dust. The air was still bitter, the sky a sallow green. She could see Alec and Isabel standing near Jace at the foot of the hill. He was touching the bracelet on his wrist and frowning into the distance. Something glimmered at the corner of Clary's vision, and she stopped suddenly. She squinted, trying to see what it was. The shine of something silvery in the distance, past the stone and rubble heaps of the desert. She took out her steely and drew a quick, far-sighted rune onto her arm, the burn and sting of the steely's dull tip cutting through the fog of exhaustion in her mind, sharpening her vision.
Simon! She said as he caught up with her. Do you see that?
He followed her gaze.
I caught a glimpse of it last night. Remember when Isabel said I thought I'd seen a city?
Clary! It was Jace looking up at them, his face a pale hollow in the ashy air. She made a beckoning gesture.
What's going on?
She pointed again toward what she could see now as a definite shimmer, a cluster of shapes in the distance.
There's something there, she called down. Simon thinks it's a city.
She broke off, because Jace had already started running in the direction she'd pointed. Isabel and Alec looked startled before bolting after him. Clary exhaled an exasperated breath and, with Simon at her side, followed. They started down the slope, which was covered in loose scree, half running and half sliding, letting the unmoored pebbles carry them. Not for the first time, Clary truly appreciated her gear. She could only imagine how the flying bits of gravel would have torn normal shoes and pants to shreds. She hit the bottom of the slope at a run. Jace was some distance ahead, with Alec and Isabel just behind him, moving fast, clambering over rock cairns, hopping small rivulets of molten slag. As Clary closed in on the three of them, she saw that they were heading toward a place where the desert seemed to drop away. The edge of a plateau? A cliff? Clary sped up, scrambling over the last of the rock heaps and nearly rolling down the final one. She landed on her feet, Simon far more graceful just ahead of her, and saw that Jace was standing at the edge of a massive cliff that fell away before him like the edge of the Grand Canyon. Alec and Isabel had moved to either side of him. All three were eerily silent, staring ahead in the dim, bruised light. Something in Jace's posture, the way he stood, told Clary even as she reached his side, that there was something not right. Then she caught sight of his expression and mentally amended not right to very wrong indeed. He was staring down into the valley below as if he was staring into the grave of someone he had loved. In the valley were the ruins of a city, an old, old city that had once been built around a hillside. The top of the hillside was surrounded by grey clouds and fog. Heaps of rock were all that was left of the houses, and ash had settled over the streets and the jagged ruins of buildings.
Tumbled among the ruins, like discarded matchsticks, were broken pillars made of shining pale stone, incongruously beautiful in this ruined land.
"Demon towers," she whispered.
Jace nodded grimly.
"I don't know how," he said, "but somehow this is Alicante."
"It is a dreadful burden to have such responsibility visited upon those so young," said Zachariah as the door of the council hall closed behind Emma Carstairs and Julian Blackthorne. Aline and Helen had gone with them to escort them back to the house where they were staying. Both children had been nearly swaying on their feet with exhaustion by the end of their interrogation by the council, heavy dark shadows under their eyes. There were only a few of the council members still left in the room: Gia and Patrick, Maris and Robert Lightwood, Kadir Safar, Diana Rayburn, Thomas Rosales, and a scattering of silent brothers and heads of institutes. Most were chattering among themselves, but Zachariah stood by Gia's lectern, looking at her with a deep sorrow in his eyes.
"They have endured much loss," said Gia, "but we are shadow hunters. Many of us endure great loss at a young age."
"They have Helen and their uncle," said Patrick, standing not far away with Robert and Maris, both of whom looked tense and drawn.
"They will be well taken care of, and Emma Carstairs as well clearly considers the Blackthorns as family."
"Often those who raise us, who are our guardians, are not our blood," said Zachariah.
Gia thought she had seen a special softness in his eyes when they rested on Emma, almost a regret, but perhaps she had imagined it.
"Those who love us and who we love. So it was with me. As long as she is not parted from the Blackthorns or the boy, Julian, that is the most important thing."
Gia distantly heard her husband reassuring the former silent brother, but her mind was on Helen. Down in the depths of her heart, Gia worried sometimes for her daughter, who had given her heart so completely to a girl who was part fairy, a race known for their untrustworthiness. She knew that Patrick was not happy that Aline had chosen a girl at all rather than a boy, that he mourned, selfishly she thought, for what he saw as the end of his branch of the Penhallows. She herself worried more that Helen Blackthorne would break her daughter's heart.
"How much credence do you give the claim of fairy betrayal?" asked Kadir.
"Entire credence," said Gia. "It explains a great deal, how the fairies were able to enter Alicante and abscond with the prisoners from the house given to the representative of the fair folk, how Sebastian was able to conceal troops from us at the Citadel, why he spared Mark Blackthorne, not out of fear angering the fairies, but out of respect for their alliance. Tomorrow I will confront the fairy queen and..."
"With all due respect," said Zachariah in his soft voice, "I don't think you should do that."
"Why not?" Patrick demanded.
"Because you have information now that the fairy queen does not know you have," said Brother Enoch. "It is rare that that happens. In war there are advantages of power, but also advantages of knowledge. Do not squander this one."
Gia hesitated.
"Things may be worse than you know," she said, and drew something from the pocket of her coat.
It was a fire message, addressed to her from the spiral labyrinth. She handed it to Zachariah. He seemed to freeze in place. For a moment he simply looked at it. Then he brushed a finger over the paper, and she realized he was not reading it, but rather tracing the signature of the writer of the letter, a signature that had clearly struck him like an arrow to the heart. Teresa Gray.
"Tessa says,"
he said finally, and then cleared his throat, for his voice had emerged ragged and uneven.
"She says that the warlocks of the Spiral Labyrinth have examined the body of Amalric Kriegsmesser, that his heart was shriveled, his organs desiccated. She says they are sorry, but there is absolutely nothing that can be done to cure the Indarkened. Necromancy might make their bodies move again, but their souls are gone forever."
"Only the power of the infernal cup keeps them alive," said Gia, her voice throbbing with sorrow. "They are dead inside."
"If the infernal cup itself could be destroyed," Diana mused.
"Then it might kill them all, yes," said Gia. "But we do not have the infernal cup. Sebastian does."
"To kill them all in one sweep, it seems wrong," said Tomas, looking horrified.
"They are shadow hunters."
"They are not," said Zachariah, in a voice much less gentle than Gia had come to associate with him.
She looked at him in surprise.
Sebastian counts on us thinking of them as shadow hunters. He counts upon our hesitation, our inability to kill monsters that wear human faces.
On our mercy, said Kadir.
If I returned, I would want to be put out of my misery, said Zachariah. That is mercy. That is what Edward Longford gave his Parabatai before he turned his sword on himself. That is why I paid my respects to him.
He touched the faded rune at his throat. Then do we ask the Spiral Labyrinth to give up? Asked Diana. To cease searching for a cure?
They have already given up. Did you not listen to what Tessa wrote? Said Zachariah. The cure cannot always be found, at least not in time. I know, that is, I have learned, that one cannot rely upon it. It cannot be our only hope. We must mourn the Endarkened as dead and trust in what we are, shadow hunters, warriors. We must do what we were made to do. Fight.
But how do we defend ourselves against Sebastian? It was bad enough when it was just the Endarkened, now we must fight the fair folk as well? Tomas snapped. And you are just a boy.
I am 146 years old, said Zachariah, and this is not my first unwinnable war. I believe we can turn the betrayal of the fairies into an advantage. We will require the help of the Spiral Labyrinths to do it, but if you will listen to me, I will tell you how.
Clary, Simon, Jace, Alec, and Isabel picked their way in silence through the eerie ruins of Alicante. For Jace had been right. It was Alicante, unmistakably so. They had passed too much that was familiar for it to be anything else. The walls around the city now crumbled, the gates corroded with the scars of acid rain. Sistine Square, the empty canals filled with spongy black moss. The hill was blasted, a bare heap of rock. The marks where there had once been pathways were clearly visible, like scars along the side. Clary knew that the guard should be at the top of it, but if it still stood, it was invisible, hidden in grey fog. At last they clambered over a high mound of rubble and found themselves in Angel Square. Clary took a breath of surprise. Though most of the buildings that had ringed it had fallen, the square was surprisingly unharmed, cobblestones stretching away in the yellowish light. The Hall of Accords was still standing. It wasn't white stone, though. In the human dimension, it looked like a Greek temple, but in this world it was lacquered metal. A tall square building, if something that looked like molten gold that had been poured out of the sky could be described as a building. Massive engravings ran around the structure like ribbon wrapping a box. The whole thing glowed dully in the orange light. The Accords Hall. Isabel stood with her whip coiled around her wrist looking up at it. Unbelievable. They started up the steps, which were gold streaked with the black of ash and corrosion. At the top of the steps, they paused to stare at the huge double doors. They were covered with squares of hammered metal. Each one was an engraved panel showing an image. It's a story, Jace said, stepping closer and touching the engravings with a black-gloved finger. Writing in an unfamiliar language scrolled along the bottom of each illustration. He glanced over at Alec. Can you read it? Am I the only person who paid attention in language lessons? Alec demanded wearily, but he stepped up to look more closely at the scrawl. Well, first the panels, he said. They're a history. He pointed at the first one, which showed a group of people barefoot and in robes, cowering as the clouds above them opened up and a clawed hand reached down toward them. Humans lived here, or something like humans, Alec said, pointing at the figures. They lived in peace. And then demons came, and then... He broke off, his hand on a panel whose image was as familiar to Clary as the back of her own hand. The angel Raziel rising out of Lake Lynn, the mortal instruments in hand. By the angel. Literally, said Isabel. How is that our angel, our lake? I don't know. This says the demons came and the shadow hunters were created to battle them, Alec went on. Moving along the wall as the panels progressed. He jabbed his finger at the scroll. This word here, it means Nephilim. But the Shadow Hunters rejected the help of Downworlders. The Warlocks and the Fairfolk joined with their infernal parents. They sided with the demons. The Nephilim were defeated and slaughtered.
In their last days, they created a weapon that was meant to hold the demons off. He indicated a panel showing a woman holding up